responses by the department on the public hearings. We are going to ask the department to take us through to the responses, and then where we want points of clarity and where we want to comment, we will do that. And then after that, we'll go and sit over whatever responses that the department has given us. We will sleep over them. And then when we meet again, I hope we would have digested everything that they have presented here. Remember, we asked the parliamentary legal advisors to come and give us some advice on the bill. They are still busy with their work. They promised us that they would be finished by Friday. I think by next week we'll be having their response, and then I think that would be the time when we have also digested the response from the department. We'll deal with them together. That's right. And the department will go on with can we have your presentation?
Thank you very much, Chair. I believe the document was circulated, Chair, to all the members. We have prepared two documents to facilitate today's discussions. There is a Word document and there is a PowerPoint that we have prepared just in case you may be required to, and the facilities, of course, are available. But I see we don't seem to be connected. So I will just speak to the Word document that has been circulated. Chair, maybe I should speak, but I should start by explaining the manner in which we had approached this exercise. We have done an assessment of all the submissions that were made available to us, and including those of the people who testified during the public hearings. And our assessment, Chair, was that most of, I think about 7 of the documents that were made available to us from the members of the public, our assessment was they really do not speak to the contents of the bill. In some instances, they are actually complaints by certain members or family members in respect of what they consider to be something that has gone wrong with the Defence Force. But in our response, Chair, we do not propose to deal with those in the sense that they don't really speak to the bill. But I think what we may perhaps do is to refer them to the relevant service or division of the Department of Defence or the SANDF, just to make sure that these people, as individuals, they get some kind of an answer from the department as to the particular situation to which they are referring to. Therefore, Chair, our answer or our responses are limited to matters that are pertinent to the bill. And Chair, as you may have noticed during the public hearing, that a number of issues were raised by all the three parties that testified. So in our response, we will not be repeating our answer in each respect. We will just refer to the answer that we had already given in respect of a particular issue. Chair, maybe I should begin by saying again that the department is very much grateful for the opportunity to respond to these public hearings, and that indeed we are encouraged by the understanding that everybody who testified seems to be supportive of the idea of the establishment of the Office of the Military Ombudsman within the Department of Defense. Many submissions attempted in one way or the other to either strengthen the bill or to take away certain parts they considered to be overreaching. So in that sense, we are very positive, Chair. Chair, in our response, we will start by dealing with the issues that were raised by Professor Montesh and Advocate B.M. Musinyane from the University of South Africa. And we will go according. Chair, I think we need to say from the beginning, if there is anything that any member feels that we did not address that was raised, we will be free to engage with that. But this is based on our own assessment as to what the issues are. if we do get, if we do miss something, the committee is free to raise those and we can see how we can assist the committee. The first issue, Chair, that was raised related to the definition of a complaint. And I think this was raised by other speakers after the UNISA presentation as well. One concern, Chair, with regard to this issue was that it is limited to members of the Defence Force and members of the public. The implication being, Chair, that if somebody wanted to act on behalf of a member or a member of the public in terms of the current definition of a complaint or a complainant, that person will not be allowed to file that complaint on behalf of that member. So the suggestion, Chair, is that we need to consider widening that definition so as to create scope for persons to act on behalf of others in terms of filing grievances. And our response, Chair, to this one is a very simple one, that we believe that the proposal is reasonable and that it is worthy of consideration by the committee. Chair, this is based on the reasoning that it is common knowledge that many members of the Defence Force, for one reason or the other, may not be able to file complaints on their own, and therefore they may require assistance, and that may be a result of resources, capacity, or even knowledge of the procedures, because the Defence Force is a big organization and there are different capacities or different levels of expertise within the Defence Force. Not everybody is as au fait with regard to legal processes as they should be. So that assistance from third parties, from civil society, may be an important part of this process to assist the department to deal with some of these issues internally. So therefore, Chair, we support the idea that the committee needs to consider this thing and will be engaging, of course, with the state law advisor and will be making concrete proposals as to how perhaps the committee can craft this to enable the third parties to be able to do that. But the idea itself, Chair, we're receptive to it. The second issue that was raised, Chair, was the issue of term of service. Now, Chair, you will recall that the current version of the bill provides for a 5-year non-renewable term for the military ombudsman. Now, the question was asked as to why limit it to 5 years and why is it non-renewable? And Chair, the simple answer for the first part of the question of 5 years was that, in our view, we had just used the normal term of government is a reasonable term for anybody to serve in office. So there was really no scientific basis for arriving at 5 years. We had just used that. It is an acceptable term in our government that people should serve for 5 years and be given an opportunity to move on. But with regard to the issue of non-renewability, Chair, the consideration came from our attempt to create an office that is at least independent. Now, you will remember from the decided cases, I understand, Chair, you still have to take a comprehensive legal opinion from your legal advisor with regard to the issue. But one issue that relates to the issues of independence, when you want to test independence, one issue is the issue of the term, renewability of the term. There is a general view that if you make the term to be renewable, there is normally a tendency on the incumbents to play to the gallery with the hope that if they make findings or conclusions that are pleasing to the authorities, they may get that second term or the extension of the term. So the idea here between us and the state law advisor was really to say, create an environment where a person knows that this is a specific term. Give them a security of tenure for a specific period, and they should be to move on so as to eliminate the possibility of trying to please the authorities or playing to the gallery. So that was the reasoning behind the non-renewability of it. But I'm sure when you get the opinion, Chair, this matter will be ventilated again. The other concern, Chair, was the issue of qualifications of the ombudsman. The current version refers to knowledge or experience in military or public administration. Now, we were referred to the institutions like the public protector, that why is it that we don't consider similar qualifications to those that are prescribed in the public protector and other similar offices like the insurance ombuds, financial ombuds, the community scheme ombud, which basically says this person may have to be a person with certain legal qualifications. And Chair, the explanation for this has to do with very much the argument that the department always presents to this committee and to Parliament, that Defence Force by its very nature is a very unique organisation with its own processes, systems and its own culture, and the culture which we should start to treat differently from the rest of the public service and the rest of the public administration. So I think the proposal with regard to emphasis on military knowledge and public administration is very much informed by that thinking, that legal qualification, as much as the incumbent may need in the process of doing his work, is something that can be beefed up in terms of legal support within the office itself. But it is our view that, Chair, if you prescribe it as an upfront requirement, you may eliminate a lot of people who may have the expertise to attend to the grievances. While if you cast it wider than that by simply prescribing what are your basic requirements, you are able to cast your net wider and attract the number of candidates who may perform in the office. But if you say legal qualified, you are limiting it to just that, irrespective of the expertise that different people may have and may bring to the office. So we would really like to cast our net wider than just lawyers, more especially with the understanding that the office can be reinforced by means of legal advisors, and that legal capacity can even be sourced outside, which is something that different institutions within government do on a daily basis. The other concern, Chair, that was raised was the issue of discretionary investigations. In the current version of the bill, we limit the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman to complaints that have been referred by the members of the Defence Force or members of the public with regard to the conduct of the Defence Force. Now, Chair, there is no specific provisions which empowers the Ombudsman to initiate investigations on his or her own. Now, I think that was the issue, that maybe we need to consider broadening the scope so that the Ombuds, if he does or she does pick issues that may require investigation, he or she is able to do so without a referral by a complainant. Chair, in our response, we state that we have no objection to the submission. In fact, we have done a comparison with other pieces of legislation of similar offices, and our finding was that most of those offices are empowered to do discretionary investigations. So we wouldn't have any difficulty with that. We will support the committee to consider such an option. The next issue, Chair, was the issue of operational deployments. Procedure must be prescribed in case of an investigation in or during an operational deployment. So in other words, there is a view that maybe the bill itself should prescribe what procedures the military ombudsman should follow in investigating in an operational area. Now, Chair, you may know that operational areas are not the same. There are different operational areas in which the SANDF operates in. An operation, for instance, in border patrol cannot be said the same as an operation in peacekeeping. Now, the difficulty we have is when you start to treat an operational area as if it's one thing, there are different circumstances which may require different procedures to be followed. So the caution we will raise in this regard was that, in our view, a matter of this nature should rather be left to the two organizations to regulate by means of a service level agreement, rather than casting it in a piece of legislation like this nature, because operational areas are not the same. So these differences in operational areas can be best catered for by ad hoc instruments between the two different organizations as to how the matter is carried out. Otherwise, we may have to come back to Parliament for an amendment each time there is a different kind of an operation for the ombudsman to be able to do his work. So in our view, that there are protocols that can be established between the Defence Force and the Office of the Military Ombudsman in each given case as to how he will or she will conduct the investigation. Chair, there was again the issue of independence of the ombudsman in as far as it relates to the reporting in particular. The issue was phrased in the sense that the reporting must be to the president as the person who appoints the ombudsman, not to the minister. This matter relates to the issue of independence and impartiality, reports of the Ombudsman must be submitted to the Minister and directly to the PP. You will remember, according to the current version, the report goes to the Minister and the Minister tables it with the Public Protector. The view is the Ombudsman should be able to directly table a report with the Public Protector. Our view, Chair, is this is a very simple one again, that the office of the Ombudsman, or maybe I should start by explaining the current grievance procedures of the department. Chair, you will know that the current grievance procedures of the department follow the chain of command. In other words, if I'm in a unit in Pongola, I start filing my grievance at the unit level. Then it goes to the formation level. It goes to the services, to the chief of the service. Then ultimately to the grievance board, which is at the head office level. So those are the different levels. But you see, the concern is, in all those different levels, the Minister of Defense is not part of that process because she is not in the chain of command. He or she is not in the chain of command. So for that reason, Chair, this office, we see it as an office that is going to assist the Minister in exercising her oversight over the department. Where a grievance has run its course and the member still doesn't get any joy, and he refers it to the Ombudsman. The Ombudsman does the investigation, and after the investigation, he refers the report to the Minister, who then looks at it and implements the decision through the department. So it gives her the opportunity for the first time in the process of the grievance to deal with the member's grievance after it has been investigated by an independent office, and then she can issue directives to the department as to how that particular situation can be corrected. So if you were to leave the Minister out of it, it means she does not have the opportunity to engage with the grievance procedures the grievances that are filed by the members of the Defence Force, because at no stage does she have that opportunity in terms of the grievance procedures, because she's not part of the chain of command. So that is the concern, why that is the issue for us, why it goes to the Minister for a corrective action. And I think, Chair, at this point we may also indicate that we need not create a situation where the Ombudsman investigates the Minister. The Ombudsman is there to look into the issues of the Defence Force, not the Minister of Defence Force, because she is not part of the chain of command. And we need to put the Minister in a position where there are problems, that she is able to intervene and make decisions as to how those problems should be solved. But she is not part of the chain of command. Chair, the last issue by the University of South Africa was the issue relating to the issue of security clearance. Again, for us, Chair, I think this is a criticism that we take to heart. The concern was that it seems from the current wording that the security clearance only relates to members of staff of the Ombudsman, and therefore not to the Ombudsman and the Deputy Ombudsman. And the suggestion was that it should be expanded to cover the Ombudsman and his staff. And, Chair, we fully agree with that. It was never the intention to exclude the Ombudsman from the security clearance processes. But by the very nature of his work, we can almost certainly say that he will have access to classified information of the department, and therefore the security clearance will be a requirement for that purpose. That, Chair, takes care of the submission by the University of South Africa. So then I will proceed to the submission by the South African Security Forces Union. That is SASN. The first issue, Chair, they raised was the issue of public interest groups. Now, Chair, this issue is very much similar to the issue of a complainant that was raised by UNISA. All they are proposing that the bill should create space for unions and associations to lodge grievances or complaints on behalf of their members. Now, Chair, we have already indicated that we are supportive of the idea which allows third parties to act on behalf of members who cannot act for themselves in respect of complaints. But here, Chair, we're raising a particular flag that, although on the face of it, this proposal is innocuous, it has the potential, Chair, to create space for unions and related associations to crowd the office of the military ombudsman with labor-related complaints. This has the potential to undermine the original intent and divert the resources of the ombudsman. Care should therefore be taken not to create space for organizations that do not have the necessary credentials to sit in the relevant structures of the DOD, that deal with labor issues to sneak those issues into the agenda of the ombudsman. Chair, this should tell you that we are concerned that, in as much as on the face of it, it appears like a very good suggestion, we are concerned that this may be an attempt to create space for unions to take what are purely labor-related issues to the ombudsman. Now, you will remember within the regulatory framework of the Department of Defense, there are formal structures that have been created to deal with labor-related issues. We have a military bargaining council, we have a military arbitration board, which is supposed to deal with those. So in crafting this proposal of allowing third parties, we must be careful that labor-related issues which should be dealt with in the bargaining council do not find their way into the office of the military ombudsman, more especially by parties within the department who have not been able to meet the necessary threshold to participate in those relevant structures. So that is a very big flag for us, Chair, that we may find ourselves in a very dangerous area if we don't craft it carefully. Chair, then again, there was an issue about the name of the bill. You will remember we are referring to the Military Ombudsman Bill. There was a concern that at this stage of our development, we cannot be having names that that denote gender to the exclusion of other gender groups. Chair, in essence, we think the proposal is understandable, and I think to a certain extent we may even support it, Chair. But we thought it's necessary that we refer you to the submissions by the public protector on exactly the same issue, where she cautioned that actually the word ombudsman, as used here, is actually a Swedish word which means an official appointed by government to investigate complaints against public authorities. In other words, the man you see there is not about gender, is about a person in a Swedish language. But with that as it may, Chair, we are saying, in our view, this proposal can be accommodated by simply referring to the office as military ombuds or a military ombuds person. Now, this is in line, Chair, with the trends already that, with regard to legislation that this Parliament has passed, financial ombud, community schemes ombud, insurance ombud. So I think just to be consistent, maybe we can just stick to that wording to avoid the perception that we may be excluding other genders. Chair, that is the last that was the last concern by SASFU. There was, of course, Chair, a lot of submissions that were made by SASFU with regard to the military justice system. And I must say, we struggle to make the link between what military justice has to do with this bill. But they dedicated a few paragraphs on just saying the military justice system is perceived to be biased or to be used by the command to victimize certain people. But we will not engage with that. As you, as the committee, will know that we still, as a department, working on a military discipline bill, which will deal with exactly with the issues of military justice. So I think that's a conversation we will need to have when we discuss that bill. Chair, then I proceed to the submissions by Ms. Lebogang Munyatsi, who was an individual who made presentations on her behalf. The first issue she raised, Chair, was the issue of territorial jurisdiction of the military ombudsman. According to her, the bill is silent on the matter, and then she posed a question as to whether the military ombudsman can therefore investigate external, can investigate complaints relating to deployment outside the Republic. And a simple answer, Chair, is that for us, the jurisdiction of the ombudsman is linked to the activities of the Defence Force, not the territory. So anything that happens or relates to the activities of the Defence Force is within the jurisdiction of the ombudsman, not so much the territory. If it happens in Burundi, and a member has a complaint with regard to how he was treated by a contingent commander in Burundi of the Defence Force, that falls within the jurisdiction of the ombudsman. So it's not so much where it happens, it's by whom was it committed. Chair, again, the issue of complaint was raised, but in this instance, it was with regard to what Ms. Munyazi considered to be a very broad wording that we use in the bill. You will remember there is a portion where we refer to by a member in the definition of a complaint, by a member of the public regarding the conduct of a member. Now, her view was that conduct of a member is too wide. It may actually include a complaint by a wife against the husband for something that has nothing to do with the defense force. And Chair, again, we fully agree with the submission that it was never the intention to bring private disputes between two individuals within the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman. So we suggest, therefore, Chair, that it's a specific proposal we make that the word official should be inserted immediately before the word conduct. In other words, now it will read, by a member of the public regarding the official conduct of the of a member of the Defence Force. In other words, that member must be acting in his capacity or at least within the official scope of his duty for that to be a matter for consideration by the public and by the military ombudsman. The issue of discretionary investigation, Chair, we have already dealt with that. We fully support that there should be a discretionary powers given to the ombudsman to initiate investigations. Limitation of jurisdiction. The concern was that the ombudsman may not entertain any dispute or any grievance that has already been referred to another dispute resolution mechanism. Now, the view of Ms. Munyatse was that the MO should have an option to take the complaint where it is of the view that delays in resolving the dispute are prejudicial to the member. Now, Chair, the concern from the department sides with regard to a proposal of this nature was that as a military organization, we have prescribed procedures which are very much linked to the maintenance of discipline within the Defence Force. If I have a grievance with my superior, I raise the issue with the relevant structures within the Defence Force before I take it outside. So the idea here is just to limit those to say, in as much as we recognize your right to go and complain to somebody else, but you have an obligation to firstly exhaust all the internal remedies for the resolution of that problem before you take it outside. It is still difficult for me to imagine how the military ombudsman, for instance, will know that there will be a delay with regard to a grievance that has never been filed in the first place. But if you look, Chair, you will recall that last year the Department of Defense published individual grievance regulations, which came into operation on the 1st of July 2010. Now, the grievance procedures that have come in now are specific in terms of time frames as to when a grievance should be dealt with by the relevant levels of grievances. If, for instance, a formation fails to deal with a grievance within a particular period, the member of the Defence Force is empowered to take it to the next level without any consequences. So in other words, if my subordinate files a grievance and I don't deal with it within a period of 30 days, that member is free to take the grievance to the next level. So wherever there is a delay, there is a mechanism to override it in terms of the grievance regulations of the department. So that is already a system that is built in the grievance procedure of the department, that people do not sit on the grievances with a view to frustrate the individual members of the Defence Force. And in fact, it goes further to even create an offence for anybody who takes steps to frustrate the right of members to file grievances. So I think within the grievance regulations of the department, there are already built-in mechanisms to ensure that there are no unnecessary delays. Of course, Chair, it takes into consideration that given the complexity of each case, there may be instances where we may need more time to investigate. A simple example could be where it happens in a deployment area outside South Africa. The time frame that you prescribe may be impossible to comply with if it happens outside South Africa. But of course, the regulations provide for extension of time and all those things. So there are built-in procedures to ensure that we do not unnecessarily delay members' grievances. Chair, I think those are the issues that were raised as we understand them. If there is anything that we may have left out, we will be free to answer questions or to provide further clarification. I don't know if my colleagues would like to add anything. It is back to you, Chair.
Members, tea is ready. Those who want to take tea, you may take tea while we talk. Now it's over to you, members. If there are any comments, points of clarification and so on. Honorable Meunier.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think it is my impression, and I think this is something that the committee will focus on when we deliberate on the bill, but it seems clear to me that the department's proposals and the legislation before us, which gives effect to those proposals, is a fairly major departure from international precedent in respect of military ombuds. And I think that that becomes apparent on page 3 and 4 of the submission, where the department states that the purpose of the military ombudsman is to strengthen the hand of the minister. That, I think, is a departure from international precedent. A military ombud, in my view, is there to strengthen the hand of Parliament in its oversight of the executive. Its role is oversight of assisting Parliament or strengthening Parliament in its oversight of the executive, including the ministry. Now, let me explain why practically it is important that we look at reorientating this proposal. When it comes to the question of grievances, the ministry is part of the problem. Members will know that over the past 2.5 years, we have all submitted complaints from members of the public, some of them serving members, some of them former members, some of them dependents of both. I myself have submitted, I think, approximately 50 grievances to the minister over the last 2.5 years. Those grievances have never been dealt with. I have, over the past 2.5 years, met the minister and met the minister's advisors. I was promised a progress report in respect of these grievances. I never received a progress report. I have approached the Secretary of Defense on at least 3 occasions, and on each occasion I'm promised a progress report. I've never received a progress report. I have now, for the record, approached the chairperson of the Joint Standing Committee on Defense and asked him to convene a meeting with the head of the Ministry of Defense and the Secretary of Defense so that they can explain to me exactly how every single one of these complaints has been dealt with. My general point being is that the Ministry of Defense is part of the problem, and it's the military ombud must be able to have oversight of the entire executive, including the Ministry of Defense. That's my first point. So I think we're going to have to look very carefully at that issue. Chair, then the more substantial point is, it seems to me that the department have not responded to the key objection during the public submission phase, and this is to some extent related to the legal opinion which we are awaiting from the law advisors. And that is the argument which I found convincing, that the military ombudsman, as provided for in this bill, is not independent in at least 3 respects. What we have not heard from the department is why they believe that that is not correct, or whether they believe, in fact, that there's merit to the argument. I think that was the real substance of the public submissions, and I think we need to hear the department on that issue. Chair, I have 1 or 2 specific questions, but I'll ask those a little bit later. I'm sure other members would like to make contributions.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair. Meunier is very fortunate. Raise my hand, and I just saw me. And I was going to really thank the spirit within which the department is handling this. And I was going that you have started like that, I might as well. Maybe it will help us if the department can tell us more about different institutions that exist, like the commission. What would be the role of the commission? What would be the role of the ombuds, which is similar to what Honorable Menier is saying, so that you can be in a position of really judging the independence of the ombuds person. Because right now, there are many institutions that are taking place within the department which were not clear that much of what is the role of this particular one. But my hand was up to say the spirit within it, especially point one. One, it shows that the department is actually aware that we are a new democracy. If they are able to say they are accommodating not only the person who is a soldier, but other people who might assist him or her. I think we know there is no community that gives that to soldiers. You've got neighbors who are not necessarily soldiers who might have extra capabilities which you don't have. And I think I want to really acknowledge that and say it. I agree people rely on neighbors, on the village, on other people who, professionals in the village who might not be really with that man or that woman when the person is undergoing a particular problem. And we treat it holistically as it is. And I thought we were going to take it point by point. I will end at that point that I'm acknowledging that, but I've already entered into what Honorable Manir was saying, that if the department can actually brief us on the different structures that exist, especially these new structures, and what is the role of the minister, what is the independence of the minister, what is the independence of this, and that one, because it has got value if we discuss the point that Honorable Manir was already saying.
Are you able to respond to that now, or do you take it as some sort of an advice to look into this matter? You are not forced to respond now if you can't respond now, but this is a hint that you must, because the parties are going to discuss it even further. I think the two honorable members are raising the same issue. And thank you.
Chair, the honorable Mr. Maynard is correct that the issue of independence was raised during the public hearings. And our understanding that the committee was going to solicit its own opinion from its parliamentary legal advice. But I have had discussions with the Office of the State Law Advisor, because when it was raised, I had to alert them that the issue of independence has been raised. Advocate Quetta is present today. He had a representative last week. So I have shared the concerns that were raised, because as a department, we felt that we are the implicated party in this particular issue. It doesn't help for me to come here and say we have created a structure that is independent. It's better when these issues are dealt with. That's how confident we are about what we have created. That's why we want to give it to the State Law Advisor and the Parliamentary Legal Advisor to debate the issue. But if need be, we will make our input as to what we consider to be the requirements for the independence. But I think the State Law Advisor here can speak to the issue of independence independently of the department. But I think the other issue that Mr. Menir had raised, Chair, is a policy issue, which I think at my level I'm a little bit hampered, because you're basically changing, as you said, the orientation of the bill. So I think at my level it may not be wise to engage with those kind of policy issues. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, my name is Mongameli Quetta from the Office of the Chief Legal Advisor. Chair, let me first apologize for my lateness, because I have a portfolio committee on certain industries that is currently running, and I had a problem with the venue as well. If that is in nature, we certified the bill. Chair, I would like to touch upon the issue of the independence of the office of the Office of the Military Ombudsman, or the Ombudsman, Chair. Chair, in our view, Chair, we feel that the issue of independence has been covered in terms of the bill. But Chair, let me go into the details. Chair, the main provisions of the bill is that there is an establishment of this Office of the Military Ombudsman, and the President appoints the Ombudsman for a non-renewable period of 5 years. And the President also appoints the Deputy Ombudsman in consultation with the Ombudsperson or Ombudsman, the Deputy Chair. Chair, the President also determines the remuneration and conditions of service of the Ombudsman and the Deputy Ombudsman, Chair, with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. And both these individuals, Chair, may only be removed from office by the President on the grounds of misconduct, incapacity, and incompetence, subject to applicable legislation. And, Chair, there's also the issue of reporting. Ombudsman reports to Parliament, Chair, and also to the Minister of Defense. Now, Chair, there is a Constitutional Court judgment, Chair, that has been concluded, Chair, earlier this year. The Hugh Glenister, Mr. President of the Republic of South Africa, Chair. In that case, Chair, I think we may have some guidance on the concept of independence, Chair, because it does give us some guidance on how independence should be should prevail, Chair, on issue of statutory bodies. Now, Chair, we may or may not know that this case dealt with the independence of the Directorate of Direct Crime Investigation, the so-called horse, Chair, vis-à-vis the former Directorate of Special Operations, the so-called Scorpions. Now, Chair, one of the issues there, Chair, was the independence of this particular new unit called the horse, Chair. But, Chair, rather laboring on the details, Chair, but the principle that the court gave us, Chair, the guidance of that, Chair, independence, Chair, means that the anti-corruption body should be shielded from undue political interference. That's a given, Chair. But, Chair, also, the court also stated that the structural and operational autonomy of the particular unit, Chair, is important. And also the appointment and the removal of the head of the particular unit, Chair, those principles are important, Chair. And, Chair, the court also held that the issue of independence should also be assessed on the basis of factors like the security of tenure and remuneration and issues of accountability and oversight. So the principles that the court highlighted, Chair. And, Chair, needless to say, Chair, I don't know whether I should go into the fact that the hosts were prepared not to be really independent, Chair, because they lack the security of tenure and remuneration, and also the issue of a renewable term of office, Chair, and also accountability, Chair, that there was involvement of a ministerial committee, Chair, in the supervision and management of the particular unit. And, Chair, in the comparing these principles, Chair, to the bill itself, Chair, the security of tenure in the bill, we can look at clause 5, Chair. And clause 5, Chair, says that clause 5, 3, that the ombudsman holds office for a non-renewable period of 5 years, Chair. Non-renewable, Chair. Therefore, Chair, if we take guidance from the Hugh Glenister case, that there will be no possibility of political interference, Chair, And then, Chair, is also the issue of the appointment is by the President, not the Minister. And there's also security of remuneration, because, Chair, the minimum salary of the ombudsman is catered for in the legislation here. Clause 5.4 states that the remuneration and other terms and conditions of service of the Ombudsman and the Deputy Ombudsman was determined by the President with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. And there's also a proviso here that the salary of the Ombudsman must not be less than the salary of a judge of a High Court, as determined by the President under the Judges' Remuneration and Conditions of Employment Act. They will share the salary of the Ombudsman is catered for in terms of legislation. Therefore, there would be no outside interference, or himself would have no fear of his or her salary being interfered with by any other individual. And also this issue of non-renewable term of office of his chair is important, because chair, the ombuds now would ensure would have no fear, or rather, there would no danger of political interference or his fear that my term may not be renewed if I do not to a certain line. And there's also this issue of reporting, chair. Now, chair, in guidance also can also be heard from this Hugh Greenstar judgment, chair. And they acknowledge, chair, that in terms of the constitution, for example, the Minister of Justice, chair, has political responsibility over the Department of Justice. The cabinet member responsible for the police is required by our constitution, chair, to have final responsibility and political responsibility, chair, for the Department of the Police. Therefore, chair, it aligns to this, chair, because it follows, chair, that the Minister of Defence, chair, does have, in terms of the constitution, chair, the political responsibility, chair, for the Department of Defence. And chair, and in terms of the judgment, chair, it was held that the financial and political accountability of the executive and the administration functions requires ultimate oversight by the executive. And the court held that independence does not really require complete insulation from political responsibility, but only insulation from a degree of management by politicians, chair. Therefore, chair, the issue, the provision, if you look at the provisions of the bill itself, there's nowhere where the minister or the executive is given powers to interfere in the day-to-day running of the Office of the Military Ombudsman, the investigations, the receipt of complaints, and all those issues. Nowhere is there the executive granted powers to interfere, chair, in my view. Now, chair, the other issue, chair, that we want to point out, chair, is that the Office of the Military Ombudsman, chair, should not be confused with the Chapter 9 institutions, chair, like the Public Protector and others, chair, because the institution that is envisaged here is a statutory institution, chair, not established in terms of the constitution, but in terms of a law of parliament. And chair, there are several examples in our legislation, chair, where there are statutory ombuds, persons, chair, like the Financial Advisory Intermediary Services Act, chair, which provide for the establishment of an office of the ombudsman, chair. There are several examples, chair, where an ombudsman receives and investigates complaints, chair. There was, chair, the test, chair, in this particular ombudsman, chair, should not be really compared with the other Chapter 9 institutions, chair, because this is just a statutory body, chair. And ultimately, chair, when the ombudsman reports to Parliament, Parliament has the power to require any person to report to Parliament. And chair, the reporting of the ombudsman to the minister, chair, it is linked to the minister's responsibility of political oversight and ultimate responsibility, chair, for the for the activities of the Defence Force. Chair, what goes into the report of the Ombudsman, Chair, it depends on the Ombudsman. Nobody else, Chair, has the power in terms of legislation, Chair, to say this should go into the report, this should not go into this report. The only thing that the Ombudsman does, it would be just to submit a report if the minister requires a report on a particular issue. And what goes into the report, Chair, nobody can interfere with. And Chair, the bill also has a provision that the Ombudsman and the office should perform their functions with impartiality, without fear or favor or interference. There's even a penalty, Chair, that if a person interferes with the functioning of the Ombudsman, Chair, there will be a penalty, Chair. Therefore, Chair, in my view, the issue of independence, I think, Chair, it is linked with the fear that the executive may have interference on its functioning, Chair. But, Chair, in my view, the day-to-day running and the management of the office of the Ombudsperson, Chair, will be independent, Chair. And there is nothing in the bill itself, Chair, that empowers anybody to interfere with the running of the office of the military Ombudsperson, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Akweta. I've been hearing that for numerous occasions. The military ombuds is not like a chapter 9 institution, but you also go on that to say that it is not produced in terms of the constitution. I'm just wondering, because the constitution is our supreme law, will it suggest that this bill will be unconstitutional? That's something that I'm aware of. It must just be located somewhere in the constitution. There's no way that it cannot be that. Honorable members, any other honorable men?
Thank you, Chair. On the question of independence, I'm less concerned with the political independence of the institution than its independence from the executive branch of government. Is the military ombud, as provided for in this bill, in your considered view, independent from the executive branch of government, given the fact that in the bill, the military ombudsman would be appointed by the president and report to the minister? That is the key question. Is the military ombudsman independent of the executive branch of government? That's my question.
Yeah, Chapter 7. Possibly what more clarity that we should seek is to check with the department and the legal team. As of yours, it's obvious that it's not something which one just woke up in the morning and decided to establish, but it is established out of thorough research and consultation. So the question then thereafter is, can the department briefly give us what is the international practice in as far as this institution is established, so as we also make comparisons?
Thank you very much. The follow-up, Honorable Gabadeli.
And also, whose interest is the ombudsperson serving? I think it will help us so much. Whose interest exactly is it serving? Why are we creating it? Thank you.
Can we get a response from the department?
Thank you, Chair. I
I think maybe it may help for me to start by referring to this bill. I know Advocate Quetta went to town about it. Chair, if you look at clause 11, subsection, subclause 3, it says the minister must provide the public protector. It firstly says the ombudsman submits a report to the minister. Then in 3, it says the minister must provide the public protector with the report contemplated in subsection 1 and must table the report in parliament. Now, and I think this was exactly intended to address the issue of accountability. Now, Honorable Mainir says the ombudsman must report to parliament. Now, it may be that I am wrong in my understanding. My understanding has always been that parliament holds the Minister of Defence for the defence function accountable. Now, the manner in which we have created this thing is exactly to close that loop. That the ombudsman investigates the complaints, makes a report to the minister. Then the minister is ultimately accountable to parliament, which is exactly why the report must ultimately be tabled with parliament. If at all parliament feels that, despite the conclusions and the recommendations of the ombudsman, nothing has been done, it is for parliament to interrogate that issue and engage with the minister on those apparent failures to implement clear recommendations to that effect. So from where I'm sitting, Chair, I may be wrong, I see a very clear line of accountability going back to parliament. So I think that's how this current dispensation has been crafted, Chair. But Chair, I need to go back to the issue of international trends. Chair, in many instances, it is very much good to do this comparative analysis. But what we must not always lose sight of is that each state has a different legal system, which will influence ultimately what you take from international trends. If you look, for instance, in South Africa now, Advocate Gweta has already touched on this thing. There is a constitution, and the constitution prescribes what we have come now to recognize as Chapter 9 institutions, which are constitutional institutions which are supposed to enforce or enhance democracy within the country. Now, the point has already been made that the Ministry Ombudsman is not a constitutional institution, is not a Chapter 9 institution. We had an option to include it as a constitutional institution in Chapter 9. Now, what is the impact of this? And again, this point has already been made, that if you look at the test of independence, how one will look at the issues of independence when you deal with a judicial organization, like a court of law, and what measures or requirements of judicial independence from a public protector or any other Chapter 9 institution, and you compare it to what will be the requirements for independence for a statutory body like the one we are establishing here. The reality tells us, Chair, that there are different levels of independence that you will require from all these different institutions. You will require a statutory body of this nature to live up to the test of independence that you will require from a court of law. That's a reality. The same way, and the Glenister case deals with this issue, that the same level of independence you want from a court, you wouldn't want from a corruption buster. But you will still nevertheless want to insulate it from political interference. And the simple reason for that, if you read the Glenister judgment, is this one. Because the corruption buster, in its investigation or in its work, is expected to investigate the executive itself. So now the concern will be, if the executive has direct influence or control over that corruption buster, how independent can it be from that executive? Now, if you look at the military ombudsman, we have just set out what the grievance procedures of the department prescribe. And we have already stated that the Minister of Defense is not in the chain of command. So if I file a grievance within the Defense Force, the grievance doesn't go to the minister. It goes to the different levels, up to the grievance board, which exists at the head office level. So if I'm unhappy, I follow the chain until I reach the grievance board, which is established by the chief of the defense force. Now, that board is established at the head office level to look at all the grievances of the department, which could not be resolved at different levels. But that is a grievance board established by the Chief of the Defence Force. A person who is not happy with the decision of that board, or for whatever reason still remains aggrieved, then goes to the Office of the Military Ombudsman for a final word on the matter. At no stage in that chain of command that I've just described now is the minister in any way. Now, the minister ultimately is accountable. If there are problems in the Defence Force, the minister is the person that the Parliament holds accountable. Gets a report from the Ombudsman that these are the problems. She tables the report in Parliament. Parliament is free to engage with the minister with regard to that issue. So we have tried to build a chain that goes up to the highest level in terms of that. But now, the challenge is, it may be easy for us to say, take whatever you find in the international trends. But if what you find in the international trends is not in line with your constitutional scheme in South Africa, what do? We would be setting a different standard. If the military ombudsman, for instance, was in Chapter 9, a different standard would be required of that military ombudsman. But the reality is not. There is a public protector there. That's why public protector remains in the loop with regard to the grievances that are dealt with by the military ombudsman. That's why the report gets tabled. And nothing prevents the member who feels that he did not get joy from approaching the public protector. And that comes out from the submission which the Parliament circulated with regard to the inputs of the public protector. That public protector, in the same way as in the Commission and the Public Service Commission. Public Service Commission is a constitutional institution which is responsible for public administration in government. The Defence Force Service Committee is a special thing that is created for the Defence Force. So there is no exclusion of the powers of the other. So that's why the point we're making is there are different levels of independence. And that, I think, is a point we should take. There are different levels, but those different levels are not prescribed by our desire to subject or to weaken the office, but because of the nature of the organization that we're talking to here. It's a statutory body. You wouldn't want it to be as independent as a court. Otherwise, it will have to go to the Judicial Service Committee and recommendation to the President and all that process, which you don't see in this bill. So it's easy, Chair, to look at the trends, but you have to look at your constitutional scheme and see if the trends fit with the constitutional scheme which governs you. But even as far as the issue of chair of it not being mentioned in the Constitution, what it does, it gives Parliament the law to make the power to make laws. Although it doesn't specifically say make a law with regard to the military ombudsman, but there is a power that is given to Parliament as the legislative authority of the Republic, which enables them to pass laws with regard to issues that they deem necessary to be regulated. But the trends are there, Chair, but they must fit with the constitutional scheme under which we have to operate.
Thank you very much,
Thank you, Chairperson. I need a clarity. I'm a little bit now lost because the department is claiming that the minister is not part of this chain of command. But to my understanding is that there is a SecDef. There is a chief of army. They are reporting whatever they are reporting to the minister. To me, they do get the reports as from their subordinates, and then they can take it to the minister. So I need a clarity now. Really, I'm a little bit confused when you say that the minister is not part of this chain of command. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. If you recall, I'm still waiting for the State Law Advisor to pronounce on independence. Just one question to the Department. The argument that precedent in other jurisdictions may not be valid is that in those jurisdictions or the legal system or the law in those jurisdictions would be out of line with our Constitution. That's the essential argument. Now, in the presentation by the advocate from UNISA, there were at least three jurisdictions which he thought were good examples and that we could learn from. Those included Canada, Germany, and Norway. Now, what I'd like to know is if Canada, Germany, and Norway, if their legal systems or whether their out of line with our constitution and therefore cannot be applied in South Africa, and if so, in what respect are they out of line with our constitutional system? I frankly don't think that the argument is valid at all. I would have to be convinced. Then the question of different tests. I've heard about Glenister from the state law advisor. What about the state versus Van Rooyen? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we have the department, Honorable Nana? You're welcome. Can we have the department responding? I think we are going to close on this matter for further discussion. Let me give Advocate Quetta first, and then we'll come to Jigala.
Thank you, Chairperson. The issue that you raised, Chairperson, regarding the constitutionality, or rather the issue of the ombudsman not being mentioned in the constitution, Chair, I think Mr. Jigela dealt with it adequately, Chair. The Parliament does have the legislative authority to legislate on the establishment of the office of the ombudsman. Chair, the issue of the president being the person who appoints the ombudsman and the president being part of the executive, Chair. Chair, I would like to fall back also on the Hugh Glenister judgment as well, that the court, Chair, gave us guidance that this kind of an institution, Chair, doesn't really require complete insulation from the political players, Chair, in the sense that, Chair, ultimately, the political oversight lies with the minister, Chair. And, Chair, the president being the person who appoints, in my view, that doesn't really make the ombudsman not to be independent, Chair, because really it doesn't necessarily mean that the ombudsperson should be completely insulated from the political players, Chair, in this respect, Chair. In my view, Chair, the constitution, Chair, or rather the constitutional court, Chair, would pronounce, Chair, the ombudsman as an independent individual, Chair, based on the Hugh Glenister judgment, Chair. Thank you. The issue of the S.S. Van Rooyen, we will look on that, Mr. Minier, and get back to the judgment.
Follow up, Honorable Minier.
Thank you, Chair. My question was, is the military ombudsman, as provided for in this bill, independent of the executive branch of government? Yes or no?
Chair, it's not a question of you can answer yes or no, Chair. Definitely not, Chair. By that date, Chair, it is in my view, Chair, in my legal opinion, Chair, it is independent, Chair. It would pass constitutional master, Chair, as an independent institution. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Njigela?
Thank you, Chair. I was just conferring with the Admiral next to me that maybe he can come in to explain the issue of chain of command. When we say it's not part of the chain of command, the regulations provide for a certain route that a grievance should follow, and that route ends with the grievance board of the Chief of the Defence Force. And in that route, there is no way where the minister is in that procedure. So in other words, if a person, after having been with the grievance board, goes to the ombudsman, that grievance at no stage did it serve before the minister or the secretary for defense. Because naturally, by virtue of their position, they are supposed to exist outside the defense force and look in to facilitate the oversight and all those. So that's what, but I want to leave it to the admiral. Maybe he can explain it better than I do.
Thank you, Chair. If I can just give an example of why we say the minister is not in the chain of command. Just as much as I'm not in the chain of command in the SANDF. I serve to support the chief of the SANDF. And in that sense, that is where the minister, as the executive authority, serves to support the president. Because he's got three appointments. He's the president, he's the commander-in-chief, he's also the leader of the executive. So that term that we use to say the minister's not in the chain of command is merely to indicate that when the president commands, he commands from the president to the chief of the SANDF for the execution of operations. When we refer to the minister in the chain of command in this context, it's about that independence that we are discussing here and discussing it with the attention that it deserves. So without elaborating on the whole command and control structure, I believe that if we understand the pertinence as to where the minister fits in first of all, within the SANDF, in our approved grievance regulations, that that is how we attempt to create that independence. It's not a sign of the fact that we don't recognize the minister, but her role in the case of our minister is in the support of that line function. So we have the line function, the command and control, and then the support. So of course, all of that allows her to be in the chain of command, not in the command process as a direct line. I'm not sure if that answers that question, but that's the best I can do under these circumstances. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Gabadeli, Honorable Menia.
Chair, I think you were right when you said you cannot finish it. I think, truly speaking, we need to ask ourselves as South Africans, why did we think we should have an ombudsman? Why we could run the country without him or her, or we cannot run a country without him or her? Why should we have such a position? Maybe we cannot really answer everything now and today, but maybe let's flag this thing and let the department really go back. And it's also because close to of page 3, if I can stand up and practicalize it, it's not clear. The ombudsman must report to the minister on the activities of the office as and when requested to do so by the minister. When you are requested to practicalize the sentence, you stand up like in a classroom situation and you really want to talk to you. It's difficult to understand this. And fortunately, it's still a bill. We are all responsible to working out this bill. It loses its meaning, practically speaking. Why do we have this office, and who benefits from it, who loses from it? What is it there for? Just in a short way of doing it, we can run the defense without it. Can we? Can we not run the defense with it? What is it that we saw necessary for us to have it? Thank you. And as I'm saying, we need not come with an answer today and now, but it's a core of the whole thing.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mene.
Thank you, Chair. Just two brief points. I haven't heard a response to my question why it is that the examples of military ombudsmen in, for example, Canada, Germany, and Finland are not valid in South Africa because they somehow are not, the legal system in the country is somehow not aligned with the Constitution. I would like to hear argument in support of that proposition. Finally, Chair, we haven't dealt, the Department haven't dealt with the first point that I made. I mean, in the case of resolving grievances, from my perspective as a member of this committee, the Ministry of Defence is part of the problem. Who investigates the ministry? The ministry have known for 2.5 years that there are 50 or more complaints on my desk which they are not dealing with. I've raised this in my budget speech. The ministry did not lift a finger to consult me about the 50 complaints and try and resolve them. It's astounding, Chair. The ministry are part of the problem. I promise you, on the day that the military ombudsman is set up, I will be the first to lodge the complaints with the military ombudsman and call for a Merumutu investigation into the Ministry of Defense. The department have not responded to that.
Honorable Mazia.
Chairperson, I'm having this question with myself that I can't answer. I'm not sure, Chairperson, whether we are already deliberating on the bill or this session was a session necessarily for us to get the feedback from the public hearings from the department and thereafter have proper session where we will raise our issues related to the legislation and also our interest as far as the establishment of the ombudsman. I'm afraid because I do not see the department having prepared themselves for the kind of questions we are raising. It is necessary, of course, for them to be knowledgeable of our expectations. But also through you, Chairperson, I would want you to please see whether is it still in line with the questions that were supposed to be posed in regard to the assessment of the public hearings or in regard to the submissions from different institutions that have submitted to the committee. And that's my take.
I'm going to ask the department to respond to whatever question has been asked, and those which you can respond to and those we cannot respond to will be responded to later. According to our program, honorable members, we are going to start our deliberation on the bill on the 31st of August. And then we will finalize the amendments on the 7th September. And we'll go on a formal clause by clause and adoption on the final vision on the 8th of September. That's our... Can I have the last person talking on this matter? Honorable Mlambo.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. If we go to our documents, on the background information about the military ombudsman, on page 4, on best practices, I don't know which practices are we talking about, where they benchmarked using international standards. Because I've been hearing the question of section, not section, but the question of the Constitution. If you go through the those three bullets, maybe the department will be able then to tell us which exactly is page 4 to maybe the department will be able to tell us exactly which best practice in terms of the Constitution of the Republic it's fit for us as South Africans. Thank you.
Can we get a response and then we are closing this question?
Thank you, Chair. I think I've reached a point where I should say I'm overwhelmed with questions.
Yes, fine.
We had expected, Chair, that we will deal with our response, but we're being asked to speak on other issues. Chair, on the issue of whose interest is this office for, Chair, I think just looking at what Honorable Nainira has told us today, he has already referred 50 grievances to the minister. That should already tell us something. That surely there should be something that needs to be fixed somewhere. If only him has already submitted 50, now you can imagine close to 70,000 members of the Defence Force, what is going on there. So obviously there is a need to have a structure that can deal with grievances or complaints in a manner that is independent of the chain of command itself. And I think this is the loop that this proposal seeks to close. That in as much as the department through its own processes deals with the grievances, it may be that because these grievances, it will be interesting to know, for instance, out of the East, how many of those went through the chain of command. The chances are you may find that the 50 of them went through the chain of command, but still the member still feels that he was not dealt with fairly for some reason. So obviously that tells you that there is a need at some point to have an office that can look at this thing, remove itself from the Defence Force, and see what exactly are the problems with how we are dealing with grievances. So I would say in terms of that, there is obviously a need, and I think the bigger beneficiary of this will be the members of the Defence Force themselves, in the sense that they will be able to feel that they have been listened to and that somebody is prepared to do something about it. Chair, with regard to the issue of international trends, and I think I will be dealing with two questions, including the one by the Honorable Mlambo.
Before, is this ombudsman a complaint platform? What it is, because my view was that the commission, the establishment of the commission, was necessarily for that responsibility of the complaints. And if I understand you well, and if you say that complaints are going to be put through the ombudsman, either there is duplication or already before even the commission begins to work, we already have passed a vote of no confidence to the commission. What is happening here?
Chair, if I may just take the committee back, we will remember that the commission deals with conditions of service. It does not deal with complaints, it deals with the conditions. You will remember the argument we were making at the time was that Defence Force is unique and therefore requires a unique system to look into the issue of conditions of service. Now, conditions of service, I don't have the act with me yet now, but the condition of service is defined in very broad terms. It includes salaries, service benefits, grievances, recommendations with regard to grievance procedures, tools of trade, and all. I think there are about over 10 things that are listed there. But the commission deals with the recommendation it makes to the minister with regard to improvement of conditions of service, not the complaints that emanate from the Defence Force. This one deals with the complaint. So that's the difference, Chair. I may have lost the something. The international trends, Chair. Chair, if you look even at the report of Parliament, and you look even at the submissions by the professor from UNISA, two things come out from these two documents is that there are two systems that are currently used in all of these countries that you are bending about. One system is for one ombudsman, which applies to everybody. In South Africa, you will have, in the same sense as the public protector. Public protector is empowered to deal with all issues emanating from the public administration. That includes the Defence Force. That's the mandate of the public protector. Public protector can deal with the complaints from the But the problem we have had over the years, hence the parliament itself undertook this mission to visit these countries and do its own benchmarking, was we were sitting with a lot of grievances which do not get unresolved. If you see even from the submissions from the public protector, the impression you will be getting is the public protector is basically saying we have grievances which are very unique to the defense force. We will prefer that a unique structure that can understand what is going on in the defense force deals with this thing, so that they come, at least if at all they come to the defense force, after having been distilled and looked at by a unique office which is able to understand how that system works. Now, that has been the debate since the time of the first public protector, Advocate Bagua. That's why within the public protector's office, all the military complaints were not dealt with by the normal investigators. There was a specific military investigator that was appointed in that office. It was exactly to cater for that uniqueness of the defense force, that not anybody can understand the nature of complaint that emanates from there. But the second kind, if you look at this benchmarking, is that it's where you create a specific office, a specialized office like this one, that deals exclusively with the military, and which is the route South Africa now is taking. That we're not going to look at an overarching ombudsman. We want a dedicated ombudsman, which is the same way along the financial and the insurance and all those things. That's the route we're taking. Now, according to all this research that we have been given here, what it tells us, Chair, is in as much as some of these countries, in terms of constitutional jurisprudence, we draw from them, but the legal system under that constitution, they differ. If you look at Canada, for instance, which is a country in Germany, if you read our constitutional court judgments, you'll find that there's a lot of drawing from those countries. Now and then the constitutional court will refer to Canada, because our constitutional system is deemed to be at least similar to it. But I think for the purposes of bringing this thing to the level of a specialized ombudsman, you then need to look in terms of what is an ombudsman in Canada, for instance. Is it created in the constitution, or is it created as a statutory body as we are seeking to do here? How is it created in Germany? How is it created in Estonia and all the other countries? You will find that there are different variants as to how they are created. In others, you may find it's created in the constitution. In others, you may find that it's just a statutory provision like this one. But the point we are making is, it's not always helpful to simply draw those things and say it must happen in South Africa in the same way that is happening in Canada, simply because the constitutional jurisprudence seems to be the same. There are policy variants that are considered, and to see as to what is it that will suit the specific circumstances of the defense force in South Africa. And I think that's exactly what is happening here. Although you go to different countries, but out of all, you decide what is it that we can create to suit South Africa. And that's what is happening. Not to import everything from these countries because they have similar offices. You look at what is it that they are doing, what is it that is best we can take from each of these, instead of simply supplanting as it is and putting it in South Africa. So that's the point we're making, Chair, that there are nuances between different countries, starting from even the culture of the country itself, that may influence you to go a particular route as opposed to the other one. So those are all the factors that influence the ultimate decision as to what kind of a creature you create in terms of your own statute. Chair, I don't know. I know I probably have not satisfied Mr. Mainil with my answer, but I think we can continue to engage as to what are all these variants, Chair. Chair, I think from my side, I think those were all the questions that I could remember that we needed to respond to.
Don't worry about satisfying Mr. Mainil. You must satisfy the whole portfolio committee. Honourable members, and I think we are done with this question, and we are still going to deliberate on the clauses of this bill. A lot of questions will come, and a lot of whatever changes we want to make, we'll make them. And we're also waiting for the advice of the parliamentary law advisor. We must also get the advisor, must also get their opinion on this matter. And then what I would caution members on is that in looking at this bill and looking at the independence, we must not be moved into letting the minister also abdicating on her political oversight, because there seems to be a thin line between the role of parliament and the role of the minister as the overseer of the department, political overseer of the department. We need to strike that balance, and also maybe looking at the role of parliament, you need to look at that section, clause 11, where it talks about that we need to understand it when we go forward. We must look at the whole matter in that context. I think that is how we should approach it. Any other thing? Honorable Minya?
Chair, I'd just like to put a general question, which we perhaps don't need to answer at this session, and which is actually a policy question, and I don't want to put the presenter in an awkward position, because I understand he comes from the legal department, but from a policy position, why is it that the department decided to introduce a military ombudsman model that is an executive model, not a parliamentary model? What is wrong? Why have the department, what factors, in the words of the presenter, led the department to reject an independent ombudsman reporting to parliament? What factors led to that specifically? Because that's what's at issue here. What were the reasons for that?
Do you have an answer for that? No. No. I think we need to do this, the question of, I've just said that, you see. We also need to look at the clause 11. What it means, I'm sure that will come when we deliberate clause by clause, because here they say the report must be tabled in parliament, and then we'll look into that when we come to it. Any other thing? Mr. Ratsuma?
No, I just want to support my colleagues, but also take issue with Honorable Menir about the minister office. I think two statements were made here. Just two.
What are you talking on?
No, I just want
to... No, but we have closed that one. No, it's fine. We'll do it. We are still going to interact. For now, we have closed it. Okay. Any other thing except the one on that question of independence, non-independence? Nothing. Now, okay. Then we'll wait for the our parliamentary law advisor. Maybe they will meet next week, isn't it? And then we'll take it up from there. We'll debate it further. Thank you very much.
That last question will be very interesting to get a response.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you very much. That was the honourable members. You must have been aware that honourable Tolo, who has served with us in this committee, is no more with us. The minister was arranging to pay homage to the family at Pelican. Now, we're checking if there are honorable members who are free. You can accompany the minister to the house. You'll give us more details. Then you'll give us more details, Razuma.
The latest information is that the family or some family members of the late Honorable Tolo will be coming to the House and to Parliament today. So the suggestion, therefore, the latest one is that when they come here, they can come to the office of the Minister at around 1 o'clock, and then maybe members can then come there to that this envisage that they arrange for the chaplain to come and have a short service at the ministry. So that is the latest information, that they'll be brought to the office at 1 o'clock when the minister is back from cabinet.
Thank you very much.
Can I quickly say that according to their cultural tradition, so am I actually, there is this practice of ukuthatha umphefumulo wakhe. It will be done at 12:30 in his office here in Max Building. It's some kind of spirit.
Hello, honourable members. Hello. I see the spiritual seers now that are consulting, because that is the function of spiritual seers. No, thank you very much. The members who can make it, please do that, and then you'll communicate with Ratum and others. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.